always record episode 20.
So you want to talk for a bit today, Mr. Violator Hellspawn?
If I can, yeah.
Cool. So I was just talking about how I was kind of hoping Bill was going to be on because he followed this experiment with playing the Beatles' White Album over Rosemary's Baby. And there's a ton of things in it that trip me out, but one in particular that was pointed out to me is that they were saying that Dear Prudence was written for Mia Farrow, and so I looked it up and found out that it was written for Prudence Farrow, Mia Farrow's sister, who traveled to Rishikesh with the Beatles and stayed with Maharishi, and so, like, that was just kind of weird, like, because when you watch it, the two together, Dear Prudence is the second song, and it's like when Mia Farrow enters the scene, it's just like, you know, it's really a potent, you know, like scenario where it's like take a good look around you and all the, you know, there's just, it really aligns to a weird degree. And then there's like this one part where her husband in the film is like on a commercial for Yamaha.
Yeah, well, hello.
Hey, Frank.
What's going on, man?
You want to be on Always Record today for a bit?
Sure, when you guys starting?
Kind of now-ish, but whatever.
Alright, yeah, sure, I'm down.
Cool. So, I was talking about Rosemary's Baby, watching it with the Beatles' White Album over it. Which is really crazy thing to do. So Mia Farrow, her sister, Prudence Farrow, the second song on the album, Prudence, is written for her. She traveled to India with the Beatles, stayed with Maharishi in Rishikesh. And I thought it was weird that there's like this scene where Mia Farrow runs up to a television set to watch a commercial that her husband's on for Yamaha. And the way that the camera zooms in on it, it just says Maha for like a while right behind him, and it was really, you know, obviously reminded me of Maharishi, and I thought that was interesting. But there's just a number of weird little syncs like that that I don't know, it's highly recommended.
I actually spoke to Andras a few days ago, and he said that he did try it, and he confirms that it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, the best timing of it, I tried like 6 different timings. And the best one that I can tell is when Paramount starts, because they basically, like, some movies, like, will have them, like, separated, like, so over time, they might change the intro. Like, if Paramount upgrades, it's, like, imagery, they'll shift it or whatever. But the way that Rosemary's Baby is made is they have this piano playing, and it's in the Paramount intro, so it'll never change. Like, they'll just keep them together or whatever. Anyways, it's, like, halfway through Paramount, so that if you're watching it like the Paramount intro, you wait a second before you start it, so that the lyrics of Back in the USSR start, like he starts singing just right after it says Rosemary's Baby. So like when that pops up, like The rest is like flawless. It's really nuts.
He said when he did it, the "While My Guitar Gently Weeps" starts playing just when you see the cops surrounding the dead person in the doorway of the Dakota.
Yeah, which is really nuts. And so right before that's Buffalo Bill, "What Did You Kill?"
Yeah.
And then it's all like, oh, dead body. But there, it's just like over and over and over again throughout the whole thing. And then I'm like, Julia, you know, there's a song, Julia. And I'm like, Julia, I remember Julia having some occult significance. And I look it up, and it's son of child of Jove, which is Jupiter. It's child of Jupiter, like... And that's playing while she's getting impregnated. And so the fact that it's her sister's name is Prudence, that's kind of far out, considering that Prudence in the Crowley Tarot, the Eight of Discs, is the virgin being impregnated. It is the impregnated virgin. So that's fucking weird.
Isn't the Maharishi the one that, like, took all their acid and tried having sex with all their girlfriends?
Probably. I don't know. I don't know.
He went there for, like, enlightenment. He was just, like, a total hippie.
I should know that. I visited the ashram in Rishikesh when I was there. And I expected, like, Rishikesh to be more, like, kind of like a Beatles, like, I don't know, like...
Mecca or something?
I thought there would be Beatles shit everywhere. And I saw one book on the Beatles in one bookstore, and that was the only Beatles reference I saw in Rishikesh. I was like, oh, okay, cool.
A tourist trap for Beatles fans seeking enlightenment?
Yeah. I thought it would be more like that, but I had one of the best days there. There's like, the beaches in Rishikesh are completely white. It's like as white as white can be. That's like the way the sand is, which is really weird. And then there's these giant fucking fish. Like, and you can go across this bridge and drop peanuts down to the fish, and the fish will eat the peanuts. Like, very, very strange. Like, I went up and down the Ganga, and I never saw fish like I did in Rishikesh. I guess it's because they get fed a lot or something. I don't know. I mean, it's like hang out there or something. Really weird.
Giant goldfish or something getting overfed.
Yeah,
the Beatles theme park still under construction is why there wasn't much going on there.
There's gonna be a giant helter skelter slide.
Yeah. The whole Yellow Submarine land.
Yeah, dude, I'd be down to go to Yellow Submarine land.
I'd go to Pepperland, yeah, for sure.
Guys dressed as blue meanies chase you around the park.
They could be the security guards.
Yeah.
The thing that she has around her neck in Rosemary's Baby is called the Devil's Pepper, which I thought was interesting. I mean, they came out with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the album before White Album, which is, I don't know, that's got Crowley in the corner there. And then Roman, the guy who's like the head warlock or whatever, his name is, you know, obviously you think of Roman Polanski, but then the character itself is modeled after Crowley completely, obviously, you know. The idea being that the book was inspired by the book Moonchild by Crowley. That's where all the people get into the whole... like Jack Parsons' Babylon working idea with it, the idea to create a golem, but I have my own ideas about that.
Devil's Pepper is a plant, even though in the movie it was a fungus.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's interesting.
Are you looking up Devil's Pepper right now?
Yeah. You know what we do when someone's talking, we're Googling like mad. It's in the Rauvolfia family. It's a genus of evergreen trees and shrubs in the Dogbane family, Apocynaceae or something.
So yeah, Dogsbane, so it's some sort of wolf's bane.
And then it's like called Apoc something. So it's like Apocalypse. Anyways.
Huh.
So there's that.
What interests me about Rosemary's Baby, I mean, there's the obvious thing of the ritual scene has this sort of strange Masonic overtone, and then you have the idea that the book cover is this they have to uncover it by shifting the letters around, right? Isn't it like all of them witches? You have to like re-scramble these letters. And it's funny to me to see how many people in the sync community do things with anagrams and such. And it's, I just think it's so interesting that a lot of this stuff kind of plays on and in a strange sort of way predates what we're playing with here.
Like a precursor to synchromysticism?
To an extent, sure. Or I mean, let me ask you. I mean, like, so Violator, you've been hanging with this crowd longer than I have. I mean, it seems like there was this what started as, hey, did you ever notice that this movie connects to this movie connects to this movie? It started as a sort of unstructured connection, then the occult starts seeping in where people go, oh, wait a second, someone's already covered this before. It looks like, oh, do you realize that if you study Kabbalah, this happens? Do you realize that, you know, the Masons already figured this out? Or is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I kind of just, like, would look at things and go, hey, well, that was like this, you know, because I, for some reason with my bad memory, I remember movies only. And then, you know, like the use of props in multiple movies or something. And then you start thinking, you know, why? Like, is there a reason or something? But really, it's our own reason. We come up with the reason ourselves. It's totally subjective, as good art should be. And then your other knowledge kind of fills it in. So usually what I'm reading at the time, like I was reading a lot of Albert Pike and... what's his face? Manly P. Hall and like Freemason stuff. And so that kind of, oh, looks like this Freemason's already kind of got something going on with this, and that works into it. And then I was reading a lot of alchemy, and so at a time, like all my posts like had alchemical references in them. But it doesn't really matter, I don't think. I mean, someone could take the number 42 or the color black or whatever and write a whole thing that you've never even thought about, but you've, you know, read everything there is to know about 42 and black. But it's just these personal, like, interpretations. I don't think you could find, like, something that's always going to be correct or whatever. Like, I think, like, a precursor, I would say, to our way of thinking would be King Kill 33, you know, with
Of course,
Jack Ruby, Ruby Slippers killing Lee Harvey Oswald, Oz, you know, and all the mystical toponymy and names and places and all that stuff that he had. We kind of do a similar thing for the most part, but I mean, my stuff kind of goes off into a philosophical or almost spiritual or religious like framework, while other people are more on the Goro Adachi, you know, trying to predict events. I don't know, it's just a whole, so like a whole, like we're swimming in the unconscious, like, you know, Val Kilmer said in the Doors movie or whatever, I swim in the unconscious.
Yeah, it amazes me that there are people that this doesn't become a spiritual or philosophical question. I mean, I've read Downard's King Kill 33. I'm actually, the book that I'm writing right now, it deals with probably like the first quarter or third of the book deals with a lot of Downard's original thesis and like expanding on it and taking a different view of it. So I'm really familiar with it, been studying it basically nonstop for the last few months, probably the last year or so. And it just continually amazes me that he sees it all as this is evil witchcraft. Every, you know, I'm finding all this stuff, and then he kind of flip-flops and says, well, these are synchronicities, but this is all evidence of evil witchcraft. And I don't understand how this, he doesn't make what to me seems like the logical leap. The next step in once you've uncovered all this is to say, you're not uncovering witchcraft, you're uncovering synchronicities, and what does that mean? Like, what are the ramifications once you realize, wait a second, no one planned this. Like, obviously someone shot the motherfucker, yet all these other things, no one planned that. No one could have or would have or should have. I just don't understand. Like, to me, it's a natural, the next step is a philosophical question.
Yeah. You've seen the movie Pontypool?
No.
Alex, the Celtic rebel, uses it as his intro to a show. I don't know if he still does, but the movie starts off with, you just see a squiggly line of, like, you know, radio waves or whatever, like a visual representation of sound. And it's a radio host talking, and he's talking about Mrs. Whatever's cat has gone missing, and the cat's name, and it's missing in this section of Canada, with there's French names and stuff, and all these things kind of overlap in Pontypool and Pontiflac and whatever the cat name, and all this like weird, like beyond coincidence, you know, coincidences. But in the end, like, what does it mean? It's just a woman and her missing cat, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So here's something. Okay. Have you guys ever had? There's this one area of our study which doesn't ever want to see anything as negative, right? It's the joy. Okay. So
it's
sink
bliss.
Sink is joy. And then you do have the the Kyle Hunt. You have that sort of Kyle Hunt Celtic rebel approach, which is that it's all, or let's even say James Shelby Downard, it's all witchcraft, and then you have your Kyle Hunts and your Celtic rebels, which are saying a good part of it is programming, and maybe there's this smaller part that's synchronicity or whatever. I don't want to oversimplify anyone's position, but I'm curious, you know, if you guys have had what we would consider like a dark synchronicity, in the sense of, you know, to say, well, oh, having these connections is joyful. Have you ever had a synchronicity that was dark or unpleasant on a personal level?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I can go on forever explaining where I think the different other media conspiracy theorists fit in their own belief system, in how they make money, or in how they've kind of created their own reality to have Men in Black, you know, traveling after them so they can make money, or so that is their belief system or whatever. But personally, I've had a whole lot of, you know, sort of direct environment conspiracies that I think Kirby Surprise talks about in a synchronicity book, where as much as I've had something that, you know, I saw the number 8, and then I turned around and there was a contest and somebody said, which number? And I just said 8. And then I won something. As much as that's happened in 80% of the time, there are those moments, like, I think I previously discussed on this show, the X-Files episode where all the machinery, mechanical devices are kind of telling the guy to end his life or kill someone or something like that. I have had the kind where, you know, it's like, you know, jump right now, or like, you know, but make sure that you slam that door right now. And like, my friend was about to come to the door, or if I would have jumped at that moment, I would have like knocked an old lady over with her bags or something, you know? So it really takes a lot of discernment, but using it as a personal navigational system, I think takes at least the kind of responsibility that ritual magic and at least an understanding of these symbols, so you don't fall into one of the traps of these huge mouthpieces who are making every movie and every music video and every cartoon look like Satanism. And those people do that, just to go off on a quick tangent and answer this, those people do that, it seems, to comfort themselves sometimes, because they don't want to deal with the reality that there's more to consciousness
or synchronicity or film that we want to come to terms with when just sitting in a theater just trying to escape this world. They want to appeal to a religious base that they might feel in their hearts they're strongly connected to. So every time they see the Ninja Turtles or something, that reminds them of Set or Satan or whatever, and then they just go write all this bullshit. There's a huge deal of a lack of digging. In other words, when you see something that is of an occult or a synchromystic nature, you're really, really selling yourself short by saying, I actually want to go figure out what that symbol is. And if it's not a symbol somewhere that somebody put in the movie for a real purpose, then you want to much more comfortably take a step back and say, hey, this is synchronicity. Some of these symbols have been around for hundreds or thousands of years, and this is finding a way to make a patchwork communication system through our media. And like you're saying, can't possibly be someone implanting these ideas and thoughts and directives, but there are a lot of cases of individuals involved in the intelligence community or the Men in Black or whatever, working with these sinks, with the Greys or whatever, working with these sinks to make a person feel like they should be at this point, at this moment, and they do get abducted, and that they'll have these powers when they come back to Earth and all of this. And if this is really just the furtherment of Nazi programs under the guise of something alien, then all that data is even that much more confused. I'm sorry, Alan, that was 10 answers to one question.
Wow. I like what you said about being careful with it, like you're careful with ceremonial magic. Because yeah. I think people can, like, I mean, if you work with sigils long enough or something, you'll have one backfire and it'll be like, you know, and I've had, you know, following sinks, like, just massive coming at me left and right. And I'm thinking it's leading one way that it's totally not, you know, or something.
Yeah. I mean, imagine if you don't know what you're doing with magic and how bad that can lead. Now, imagine if you don't know what you're doing with just general symbols from Egypt and stuff. And if you're already fundamentalist and how terrible of a reality you can create for yourself if all these things appear evil. I'm sorry to cut you off, Violator. You were saying?
No, it's fine.
No, but I think that's exactly it. I mean, you look at guys like Vigilant Citizen, you know, who of course is a shill. You know, he's in it for the money.
Right.
I can't tell if he actually believes any of that. But on the other hand, you are promoting this idea of a really limited knowledge of symbols and this really quick, this equals this. If you see a triangle, you know, if it has an eye in it, then, you know, if you see a triangle, it's evil. If you see a triangle with an eye in it, holy shit, that's evil.
Right.
And,
well, here's,
you know,
if you get these cats who are like, you know, oh, I don't want to be like my parents, all that Christian bullshit, so I'm going to go after Lady Gaga or Marilyn Manson's newest statement about anti that. And then meanwhile, they're not even getting into the space where they'd be doing any psycho-spiritual work. They just know they're anti the thing that may even be morally somewhat useful, you know, in someone else's religion or something.
You know what? Just to go into this anti, not so anti kind of thing, I just watched a video. I think someone linked it somewhere on Facebook, and I didn't get around to watching it, so I don't know if this is old news, but it was this guy channeling Saturn, the energy Saturn, and basically Saturn, Lord Saturn, who comes through our solar system as this god of time and obstacles and, you know, that kind of stuff, color black, element lead, all the typical Saturn stuff that we all know and familiar with. And Saturn was saying he's really upset with the quote-unquote Illuminati and the kind of genetic manipulation and transhumanism, because this goes against Saturn's law of time and things happening in the correct order and all this. And so it was interesting that Saturn, the hexagon, 666, black, you know, death, time. This entity is actually on our side, supposedly, according to this guy channeling. And so you have people talking about Saturn worship, but really Saturn, according to this medium, wants to stop the Illuminati because the Illuminati are going against the plan, you know.
Yeah.
That's so funny. I mean, so I can't speak to channeling Saturn, but just in my own meditations on it, that's exactly where I come in. It's like, I feel like Saturn is probably the most misunderstood archetype currently being analyzed. And I thought even more about this. It's something that speaks to me personally. I mean, I'm born on New Year's Eve, so like Saturn's really big to me. Like just on a personal level, I'm constantly seeing sinks there. And I have a tattoo on my back that I was just this thing that I kept as a child, kept drawing over and over and over again. And then when I turned, I don't know, like 18 or something, I just got a tattoo of it, never knowing what it meant or whatever. It's just something that this image in my mind. And then being older and seeing the alchemical or astrological symbol for Saturn, that's basically what it is. It's incredibly close to the symbol for Saturn. So like on this personal level, I always see it. So I was doing these series of radio shows, and you know, if you go on the more conspiracy radio show, you say certain things. If I went on there as James Shelby Downer, people would go, yeah, okay, there's witchcraft and there's Illuminati and there's whatever. Yeah, okay, you tell me how they control everything and I'll understand. But when you say, actually, I think it's a little more confusing and complicated than that, I was always kind of expecting this somewhat of a backlash. And I was surprised, like, okay, people are understanding what I'm saying and they're not freaking out. Okay, everything's good. And they would only freak out when we got to, if we touched on Saturn. The minute someone would say something about Saturn, I'd say, well, actually, I think Saturn is a really misunderstood archetype. I don't think it's evil or satanic. I think it's, you know, it is the fundamental structure of time that could be a very beneficial thing of, yes, there's death, but there's death and rebirth. If you look at why is Saturn associated with agriculture, you know, to have things grow and a cycle of birth, death, decay for agriculture is not a bad thing. We need that to survive. And people suddenly would freak out. What do you mean Saturn's not evil? And, you know, are you defending pedophiles and what? And it's like, well, how the fuck did you go from agriculture to pedophiles?
Yeah, it's like it feels like a diversion almost, like it's part of the programming to have that understanding of Saturn. Like I pulled up just now the last of the Trump cards or Major Arcana in Crowley's deck, and you can see obviously like the universe is associated with Saturn there, and with Ramoth in 16th century Kabbalah, different from the Golden Dawn set of associations with the tree, Saturn is Malkut. So, like, Saturn is the Shekinah, is, like, the divine feminine. Like, that's the association. And Jupiter is Yesod, which is right above. And so, like, that's fucking interesting, especially considering where, what pathway the universe lands on for the Golden Dawn in between Yesod and Malkut. Saturn is, like, the foundation of the whole tree that way. Which is also exile, right? Yeah. That the Shekinah is in exile, and then Saturn is also put into exile. Like, that's, you know, it's kind of crazy.
And that seems to be where we're at, is people want to demonize it. This was something that I've been thinking a lot about, is this idea of we bastardize something and then we demonize it. Like, something, you know, I don't know, music, sexuality, mythology, all this stuff. We completely bastardize it till we have a really crappy pop song with cheesy quasi-pop occult symbolism, and then go, oh, that's really bad. It must be evil. You know, it's like, if we go back before it's completely bastardized and made foolish, there's that. But so, of course, you're saying Saturn as Malkut. I mean, you have this idea of Saturn being, you know, the golden age of Saturn, Saturn being the father in mythology and all this sort of stuff, that this is the origin. And there's even someone now, it's really interesting, there's this guy promoting this idea that actually, astrologically, Saturn hovered directly over the Earth. Like when humans were, you know, first on the planet Earth, they would see Saturn, like, right above them. And he creates this whole complex electronic model of the universe to explain how Saturn used to be essentially like giant in the sky, like where our moon was and things like that. And he extends this whole complex model and then says, this is why we have Saturn worshippers, and this is why there are these evil Illuminati worship Saturn. But it would seem to me that, you know, we have sun worshippers from forever because of the sun, but it's not, I don't think you could just across the board say that sun worship is evil. You know, there are Christians who are worshiping sun symbolism who are really nice people, and then there are Christians who are terrible people. There could be a Saturn worshiper that's awesome and a Saturn worshiper that's terrible. I mean, I think
it comes with... no, you go, whoever that was.
No, you go ahead.
You know, I think that there's the major disassociation comes in with people who may not fully understand ritual magic, but use it at a high elitist power, and the idea that this red character who gives you things if you ask him for them in the material world, Saturn or Satan, is lead, and that lead, of course, needs to be transcended. But even when transcended, we get back to things that the quote-unquote Illuminati would be involved in, like oil and gold, which kind of go hand in hand, and go back to Saturn. So if they're looking for mascots, that's certainly a god that they can turn to make look like their own, especially if pedophilia has a lot to do with the Vatican, things like that, and whatever kind of, I don't know, weird black magic plans they may or may not make for all of these archetypes to play out in a physical way on the Earth. And I've made a note about that on my blog, Violator and Trevor, and some other work about even the South Park episode where they BP drills for oil, they release these Cthulhu-like deities, and there's a long list of sinks where, like, digging or oil releases or black oil, like in the X-Files, is all interrelated, and I see that as Saturnian. But for one thing, if you have some kind of energy or archetype or god that represents Saturn, that communicates or channels with anyone on the Earth, what I would see happening is that if that character, that entity, that deity is responsible for time and the way things happen and the way natural cycles are supposed to go, then if there's another group of entities or an entity that has mastered the manipulation of not only that time but memory in our realm, then there would obviously be some kind of conflict there, whereas if there was someone really responsible for time, like Saturn, you'd want to make him look like a horrible villain in the way that Lucifer and Saturn are always immediately depicted a certain way because of fundamentalist beliefs and never so much deep reading. And then, I think that's all, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you know how there's a correlation between Saturn and Osiris? Yeah. You know, both lords of time and death and agriculture. Well, yeah. I was watching I think it's Food Incorporated, it might have been. I was just watching a documentary like that. It might have been Food Incorporated, where they use this graphic to show, like, a chart of all the things that are made out of genetically modified corn. So they put up this, like, cartoon cob of corn and then start pulling off all the kernels and saying, this is used to make, like, modified, you know, corn syrup. This is used to make potato chips and, you know, whatever, whatever, whatever. And I was just watching this piece of corn getting pulled apart to make all these highly toxic substances, and it occurred to me, like, very quickly, like, wait a second, this is the dismemberment of Osiris right here that I'm looking at, and what they're doing is someone is dismembering him and reassembling him, and when we say him, what we're really talking about is the archetype of time and earthly structure, and of course, alchemically, Saturn is the earth, you know, can be thought of as obstacles, but also just natural fundamental laws that you have to work within. So the idea that you're taking these things and you're trying to restructure them in quote-unquote unnatural ways, the things that you're coming up with are highly toxic substances. And I was just looking at this graphic going, this is a Frankenstein version of Osiris. They're dismembering him and reassembling him into this ugly thing instead of reassembling it into something proper or useful. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So okay. Just really quickly, Malkuth, if you look at a correspondence between Saturn and Malkuth, Malkuth literally translates as empire. Although in most places, like the Golden Dawn, you'll see they call it kingdom. And then if you consider that, if you look at Malkuth as the Shekhinah and then realize that the Shekhinah is replaced by the horror of Babylon and the Scarlet Woman, right? And that she is literally taken to be empire. She is Babylon, right? The Babylon itself is a woman. It's like American Woman, the song when he's singing about her. It's like, you know, I don't need your war machines. I don't need your ghetto scenes. You know, colored lights may hypnotize, look in someone else's eyes. Jim Carrey sings it in The Cable Guy, where apartment number is 42, and there's all this super, association with Jim Carrey as Zeus in that. But anyways, whatever, all that aside, that's just an interesting parallel if you look at the idea of empire being like Osiris, like if you build it wrong, you know, like, look what you got, you know, Leaning Tower.
I think that in every way, this stuff is supposed to be taken in mass, like thousands of people at once, sometime after World War II, realizing that all of the Kabbalistic references and all of this stuff was an alchemical process where lead or Saturn needed to be transcended to the die and be reborn like Osiris. And I think what the Illuminati or whoever in question has made an over effort in trying to externalize these things. And the way that we heard, we lost some civilization that was way before recorded time because of technology and possibly had to do with Mars. I think it's the same thing at work if you're superimposing memory and time like you would be technology instead of chakras or things like that. Then you're forcing the hand of something that there's going to be some kind of, I guess, backlash, or one civilization that's fighting against another one psychically with us, for us to either become, you know, technocratic or technologist or whatever, or these golden transcended superhero men or whatever.
Right. And Mars gets the same deal, because Mars now is equated with Gevorah, but then Gevorah gets the worst rap ever, because Gevorah is like, it's intense energy, right? But it's also feminine. It's like the fury of the feminine, which is like something that, you know, I could see why that would definitely like scare some people more than just like, you know, Satan would. It's like, you know.
No one wants to piss a woman off. No one wants to do that.
Well, if it's Mother Earth hanging in the balance, you know, I think it's very literal. There's all these energies floating around her, and then, you know, if she gets upset, she might just wipe half the planet off by her own decisiveness. But if that's very, very interlinked with our own mental structuring, then, you know, we can temper that.
And that's perfect. I mean, the idea is that the agriculture and Mother Earth, whether it's, you know, a masculine Osiris Saturn figure or it's a feminine Mother Earth Gaia figure, it's the same concept. Are you guys familiar with, what's his name? Grant Morrison, his talk at Disinfo, where he says what the fifth dimensional beings taught him was that things grow in time, was the idea that, okay, we exist outside of time, but we have to enter into time because that's the only way things grow. Right. That's the perfect, I mean, to me, that actually makes a tremendous amount of sense. Again, whether or not you're channeling entities, whether that's a literal truth or not, it makes perfect sense that, yes, you need the natural time cycle for things to grow.
It's thought, Lord. You got it, man. I'm sorry.
Only time. Enya. Okay.
Wait, Alan, what did you just say? I'm sorry, Grant Morrison. It's thought larva, the ability that you can grow these entities in the universe to contain, you know, your own worlds. And when you begin to look at it just categorically, we could see that H.P. Lovecraft had his very own thought larva, which then he developed into these other, you know, deities, which may or may not be, you know, from Abdul El-Hazar to the Necronomicon or Peter Lavenda's imagination or whatever. But the point is that, you know, it may look like this weird, like, larva growing in the universe, and then you can do whatever you want with it, and it doesn't necessarily have to turn into giant, really scary tentacled horror larva. It can become, you know, a building or a book or something like that.
A woman in red. The the initial or first definition of matrix is an environment or material in which something develops.
Matrix is womb, literally.
Yeah.
Etymologically, it means womb. Which is so interesting that he wakes up out of the matrix into a womb, basically. Yeah. He's like in a fetal space.
An amniotic fluid.
Yep. And he gets birthed out of the thing. Yeah, that's an example.
Same with the rebirth of Judgment or Judge Dredd in the first film.
Mm. Or Austin Powers in the warm liquid goo phase of unfreezing.
There you are.
I think it's really like very telling, like on people's like a classic European occultist relationship to a lot of how where they decided to go and make the norm with these symbols, because you can see how as soon as they equate Gevura with Mars, Gevura was the sun. And then they're called the Golden Dawn in the first place, and often picture the Golden Dawn symbol rising up from the place of Tiferet. And that's kind of, I don't know, that seems kind of like a slight purposeful manipulation of the matter. You know, they're like, they give the placement to the sun, but the sun was itself the, like, basically that there is a power in receptivity, I guess, is the implication, in its own kind of way. Like, they push for this will, they put will in the place of Tiferet, and I think it's like, you know, it's connected to like love is the law, love under will, and the Selene idea of that. But then I don't know, that just, it seems so like telling to me that they go there with it, you know, that's their interpretation of the nature of empire, what empire needs in order to establish itself, not realizing that empires don't exist without cooperation. It's like as if they were impressing competition onto the whole thing, as if contrast was conflict at its base or something, you know.
Wait, no, I don't know exactly. You're saying like the symbolism of the Golden Dawn seemed more like it had an appropriation toward the state or than the individual?
Yeah, well, basically they took, so there's a number of things. First, you know, they take what was Saturn and make it into Earth, which with the Malkuth. So the Malkut, which is empire and kingdom and the foundation of the tree, they change into Earth. And then they take Gevura and make, which was the sun itself, which is the divine fucking power of the feminine, and they give that over to Mars. They equate that with Mars. And so I'm just saying that's like very telling in terms of their relationship to empire in the first place, or what they would expect would make an empire powerful. But it's interesting because they look at the whole thing like a mandala in the first place, which is reasonable. But I mean, if you're really attempting to create the new Jerusalem or whatever you want to call it, you know, why would you go about it in that way? Unless if that's like that's how you gain power or something. I don't know. It's a weird set of correspondences for those things when you look at what those things were and their origin.
I was reading something the other day where they said the Golden Dawn actually had like 24 or more major arcana in their tarot, like secret cards that people don't know about, and one of them, the 24th card, was a red dragon.
Oh yeah, I've seen those. Yeah. Or maybe I saw those in a dream. I fucking, I'm holding right now a Golden Dawn tarot. But I don't, it's just a standard deck. But I feel like I've seen that at some point. Like somebody had that and I was like, what the fuck? You got extra cards. Maybe it was in my dream. That's weird.
The Simpsons had the Simpsons had a 23rd trump, the happy squirrel.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's weird. But anyways, like, you know, Israel Regarde did a book, The Garden of Pomegranates, which is a reference to Ramak, which means that there's, like, they don't, it's not like, where did they get this stuff? Like, they got it from, like, these occultists from, like, 16th, 15th century, but then they never give them direct credit. They never say, this is where I got this. They just drop the information. And then they give obscured references to those people. I say occultists, but they're rabbis, you know? And then most of these people don't read Hebrew, which is fine, but it kind of makes it challenging, I think, to take them as an authority on the matters in certain ways. I mean, it's like at least biblical Hebrew. Like, I don't really care if they speak Israeli, but I mean, because that's kind of disappointing newer. But like, to be able to read Hebrew seems like if you're going to basically make the foundation for everyone else's work, like that might be helpful. I mean, they equate Malkuth with the feet on the tree. Like, they'll represent it with the feet, and it's the tip of the dick. You know, like, so does the genitals, you know, or the clitoris, actually, literally, like, you can see that it's taken that way in Hebrew text, you know. It's just that the tip of the sensation there, which is interesting if you look at it in terms of Kundalini being like Wilhelm Reich's orgone energy, you know. If you look at it, like, and that's what the alchemists believe, that the whole thing is basically, that sexual energy is no different from the energy of the creation of the whole universe. It's just... there's a distinction, but there's no separation there.
But,
you know?
David, I think this is... I'm completely comfortable with that seeming paradox, because I don't think it really is a paradox. Malkuth is Earth, because it's the... let's think of it at first as an actual tree, and then the tree is a man. Let's consider both. The tree enters into the Earth. That's where its roots are. It's rooted into the Earth. So to have that Malkuth be the Earth where it's planted into is fine with me. Then to have it be the feet or tip of the dick is essentially to say, if it's the feet is where you, the man, Adam Kadmon, makes contact with the earth. And if it's the tip of the dick, it's again, the tip of the dick, same as the roots of the tree, it's where you're entering into that earth. So it is this sort of alchemical union of the masculine and feminine. So you have the tip of the dick and you have the feminine Gaia, Mother Earth, that it's entering into, and it's literally all of those things in one spot. Like, I don't see it.
Well, literally, the word itself that's used, I forget what it is from the Hebrew, but it is the same word. And that's the issue, is that they find a word and then they're like, oh, this is what this means, but it could just as easily mean otherwise. But I feel it's very telling. And then when you look at the fact that you have the world card, the 22nd major arcana is the world, it's Earth. And then you're like, oh, okay, Malkuth, like the path between Yasod and Malkuth, and you establish it there, that is the root, right? And then you look at Crowley and he renames it the universe, showing that it's not just the world as we know it, like that is like one way to communicate it, but it's beyond the world, it's the universe itself. It's the foundation for the rest. It's what everything else depends on. And then he equates it with Saturn and Toth, obviously the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which is a, like, if you're to represent the Hebrew alphabet as musical notes, Toth is a half step. So, like, if you, like, between scales, like, you have, like, okay, a set of notes, and then you have the what's in between that and the next level of notes, you have this half step, and then that is the Toth, meaning that you're inferring that there's a whole, that the end is also the beginning of something else that's unknown. And then that is all, like, to equate all of that with Saturn is just really interesting if you think about Saturn in exile in the same way as the Shekinah.
Absolutely. And the Shekinah, we can, you know, make this sort of correlation to the shattered vessels and all this sort of stuff. So you have, just as Osiris is dismembered, you have this sort of Sophia Shekinah split as well. So, I mean,
sure.
Like, all of these things sort of make sense to me. I want to jump from here, if I can, into the idea of the Wheel of Fortune. Because to me, a natural time cycle and a Saturnian, an actual Saturnian cycle or a natural time cycle, what makes sense to me, why a more pagan... you know, we have the idea of the wheel of the year. You have these, the more pagan appreciation of that there is a natural time cycle. something like that, we can see connected to the Wheel of Fortune. And, you know, Violator, you brought up King Kill 33, and this idea of the killing the king, to me, again, is intimately linked to the Wheel of Fortune. And there is this medieval concept of the Wheel of Fortune. They called it Rota Fortunae. And you would see a wheel with at each of the four cardinal points a king at a different stage of his reign. And at the top, he's sitting on a throne. And to the right, you see he's falling off it. And on the bottom, he's like laying on the ground. And on the left, he's climbing back up. And it says at the top, I reign. On the right where he's falling, it says, I have reigned. And or I might be confusing the right and the bottom. And then it says, I will reign again. So he's, you know, this is the fall of a king and the rise again. If you look at the movie Dangerous Method, I just watched Dangerous Method for the first time this week. I've discussed with Will Morgan that Viggo Mortensen, who plays the king in the Lord of the Rings cycle, right, the Return of the King, well, that's the guy, I Will Reign Again. That's him climbing back up that wheel. His name, Viggo, is like ego, and Mortensen. His name is literally Ego Death. Right? Now, he plays Freud in this in Dangerous Method, which we can kind of associate Freud as a sort of egoic figure and Jung as the subconscious explorer, right? So it's sort of ego-id, not exactly, but you kind of get me. Notice, if you watch Dangerous Method, you're going to see that every time you see Freud when he goes for his walk, he says, oh, I love to walk around here, and you see him many times standing in this outdoor garden path. He's constantly positioned in front of a statue of a Sphinx. Now, it's the Sphinx that sits atop the Wheel of Fortune.
Oh, dude.
Right in the Rider-Waite, and a lot of the older decks, you see a Sphinx sitting atop the Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah. So, this is crazy. So, I've been tripping out on this card in terms of, okay, so King Kong climbs the Empire State Building, right? He dies at the tip of the Empire State Building. If you equate the Empire State Building as like a phallic symbol, like Osiris's dick, right? And then you recognize that also Empire being the Malkuth, like he's climbing this point, right? And there's the union of Za'er, which is Tiferet and Malkuth and all of that symbolism. Like he dies in the sexual act with King Kong, and then you have the whole 11-11 thing and everything that ties into that. But then what's weird is that the same people who did King Kong did Mighty Joe Young, where he dies on a giant wheel. Like, he gets crushed by the fucking, like, Ferris wheel, right? And so if you look at the Wheel of Fortune card, like, right now I'm holding the Golden Dawn version, but you can see it on any of them, you have basically what they're showing is a simian, which, you know, I thought maybe it was supposed to be, like, Hanuman or something, but they don't really say that. They say Typhon. But what's weird...
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
It's this ape climbing the fucking wheel, and then you have Mighty Joe Young gets crushed by... it's the same people who did King Kong. So it's like there's this correlation between... It's very telling.
I'll give you one more. The word Kong is the Chinese word for zero.
Perfect.
So he's King Fool, like zero being Fool. It's the beginning and the end of the Tarot Trump cycle.
Right. Like
King Zero.
The one is the Malkuth. So you have, so he climbs originally the Empire State Building, which is the Malkuth. And then you have this equation with that, and then the zero of the wheel. And then it's 10. And then it's X, too, which is just perfect as a Roman numeral. And then you have, you know, everything with X. X marks the spot, basically, right? Yeah, it's crazy.
There's a good wheel scene in the second or third Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Oh, is everyone still there?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. It has Johnny Depp, Orlando Bloom, and the guy who played the, like, admiral in the Navy was discharged and then got his job back. And they all have their own character arcs. Johnny Depp was a king of the Cannibal Island, and then back to being, you know, chased pirate. And they're on this big water wheel that breaks loose of a building when they're sword fighting, and there's three of them are going around this wheel as it rolls along the island, and they're, you know, taking different places and going up and down on it. And very much, you know, three figures on a spinning wheel.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And yeah. What about the fact, I mean, Johnny Depp is in the movie Dead Man, and we have this idea of Johnny Depp as this sort of underworld figure. I don't know if you know, there's the Jim Jarmusch film Dead Man.
Right, yeah.
Yes, I love it.
Add it to the tarot blog.
But yeah, I forgot that there was three of them on that wheel in that movie. You're absolutely right.
And right before that, Johnny Depp runs away, but he falls into an open grave and then he pops out. So it kind of looks like the judgment card with people like standing up out of an open grave. Mm. There's a few more. I can't really remember them all. It's all notes on my other computer. I don't have. Does anyone like Star Wars?
Sure.
Yeah.
I've been watching a lot of Star Wars recently. So I just watched Episode 4 last night. And I was remembering there was a blog or website back in the day that's not up anymore. Way back when I first started getting the synchronicity thing. And his whole point of view was that the movies, the original trilogy, was Luke Skywalker's story about what had happened. And that Luke Skywalker was basically manipulated by Obi-Wan and had no Jedi powers. Because no one, until I think he fights the Emperor and he does a force grab on his lightsaber. I don't think he does the force. So, like, when he does a force grab in the cave on Hoth and kills the Wampa, like, no one sees that. So this is Luke's, oh, yeah, and I pulled my lightsaber out of the snow and it was 3 feet away from me. Like, yeah, sure, Luke, whatever. But he's really, like, gun-ho. He takes on an AT walker by himself. I mean, he's just crazy, you know, crazy pilot. And it's basically this guy's point of view is that Obi-Wan was a manipulator, told this guy he was basically invincible and got him to be this great soldier just, you know, through brainwashing. But anyway, so I was watching the movie with that kind of in the back of my mind. And R2-D2 is on Leia's Rebel blockade runner ship with, at the beginning of the movie, it's being shot at, you know, on the big Carillion ship or whatever's about to suck it in and board it. And so you got R2-D2 with Leia, and then he gets ejected, and then he ends up on Tatooine with Luke Skywalker, who's been living under his dad's old name all these years, and apparently Darth Vader hasn't found him. And then Obi-Wan happens to be already there waiting for him, and R2-D2 goes, you know, ends up at Luke's house, shows Luke a clip of the Leia message to get him intrigued, but has Luke remove the restraining bolt because he can't supposedly play the whole message, which is a lie. So R2-D2's already manipulating Luke into getting rid of his restraining bolt. Then he runs to Obi-Wan after, you know, Luke's heard the message with Obi-Wan, and he asks his Uncle Owen, you know, who's this, is this, like, old man? So then he goes and fights Obi-Wan, and then Obi-Wan has him there while his aunt and uncle are being killed by the stormtroopers. So Luke is now saved from the stormtroopers, but also has no reason to stay on Tatooine and can join Obi-Wan in his damn full crusade after he shows him a lightsaber and tells him all these great stories about the Clone Wars and whatever. I mean, if you watch it with the manipulation idea in mind, it's almost like R2-D2 was sent on a mission specifically to get Luke to join the rebellion. And R2-D2's got that big single eye that doesn't light up, but it's just a big circle, and I was thinking that's like Hal's, you know, Hal 9000's right on. Because Hal lies to Bowman and them, you know, telling them that that part is blown out and they need to replace it, and he cheats on the chess game.
Yeah.
So you have this manipulative robot, and then of course Luke's on Tatooine, which has two sons, which is in 2001 A Space Odyssey. At the end they have the second son, Lucifer, and there's this weird crossover between the two movies. I don't know, it was just...
Right, we were talking about this last week.
Yeah.
And the fact that if you look closely on The Phantom Menace, there's a scene where Ewan McGregor, Obi-Wan, is walking along, I think, with Luke. Anyways, the fucking pods from 2001 are in, like, a junk heap, like, next to him, if you look closely. You could probably, if you just type in, like, 2001 pods, Phantom Menace, it might show up. Here, let me see.
I would like to see that because, basically, with the idea of the controlled manipulation makes sense because, 2001 pods and Phantom Menace, absolutely, I see it. Wow, that's pretty fucking interesting.
Uh-huh.
So,
equating it with sperm, the attack on the Death Star as, like, sperm to a giant fucking egg, and that the birth is the death, you know?
Well, yeah, I want to get there. I just want to back up a second. So you were saying the idea of the manipulation, just to throw out that in Phantom Menace, they show that Anakin builds C-3PO, which seems like such a complete foolish plot point, unless, of course, there's this sort of setting this whole thing into motion that C-3PO, of course, works for Darth Vader.
That was another thing on this whole website, where C-3PO was built by a master, you know, Force user, so C-3PO actually has the Force, and the Force can't be used against criminals. Jabba the Hutt, you know, Waddle, or whatever the guy that owns Anakin when he was a slave, none of them are affected by the Force, and neither is Han Solo. Every time C-3PO starts talking, Han covers his mouth or tells him to shut up.
Yeah.
Or turns him off. Because Han knows that he's a manipulative, you know, Force user, and he's trying to brainwash him, and he's a criminal, and he's not affected by this kind of thing.
So check this out. You mentioned King Kong. Now, King Kong is our classic Beauty and the Beast, right? So, I'm going to tie this all together, if possible. So King Kong is Beauty and the Beast. Even at the end of the first one, it says something like, you know, the love has tamed the beast, or something along those lines. Now, he climbs the tower and then falls the tower. This is a very sexual act we see, right? It's essentially like his erection, and then he has petite mort, he dies, and the tower, essentially him falling off the tower or the tower falling. So you can see it all like that. The Beauty and the Beast we can associate with the strength and or lust card of the Tarot. This is something else we discussed last week in a non-recorded section, but one of the things Downard points out, right, Oz, the word Oz means strength. Well, Oz is 77. Oz in Hebrew is 77. It has the value of 77. So strength, the strength card of King Kong climbing and falling is 77, is Oz, is the King Kill, is all these things. In the older tarot cards, that card wasn't known as strength. It was La Force. It's the Force. So this sexual thing is the Force. What year does Star Wars come out?
1977.
77 being strength, Oz, Force.
Dude, I can't, like, this is too perfect, because I was just this whole time while you were describing your interpretation of Star Wars, I couldn't help but think of the fact that the Wizard of Oz is the same thing with the witch. Basically, only evil witches are ugly, and this whole assumption with Glenda that she's, like, the good witch, while meanwhile she's the one telling fucking Dorothy to go to the wizard, who's a giant trickster, who you'd think that the witch would be aware of, and the fact that the trickster gets all he wants is to kill this witch. Like, the witch doesn't, like, kill anybody. She's just trying to stop Dorothy. She's saying, surrender Dorothy. And then, meanwhile, fucking, she kills the witch and gives, and all the wizard wants is the fucking broom, because it's real magic, and he has no real magic. He's all show. It's a similar kind of parallel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now, so take, if this whole thing is, in a sense, a sexual act of this force or lust, the 77, to me, I see 77 is the rising kundalini and 777 is the lightning flash down the tree. So I see these as intimately related. It's, in a sense, it is the wheel, but it's also just this, it's a rise and fall. It's a sexual act. Now, when you take that into consideration, what I was thinking about a few weeks ago, and this pod, this 2001 pod being in Phantom Menace kind of seals the deal for me, as I was thinking of Star Wars as taking place after 2001, A Space Odyssey. And like you said, there's two suns, that he's on Tatooine and there's two suns. Now, think of it this way. The Death Star, it is full of stormtroopers that are all dressed in white, and we later find out they're all clones. So they're identical people, little tiny white fucking identical things inside this giant, what, egg? So these are all little sperm, and the whole point of the movie is to try and get that, be the one who can penetrate it. So Luke, his whole thing is like, oh, it's so hard, it's a one in a million shot. Well, isn't sexual reproduction is a one in a million shot? There's a million fucking sperm, and only one of them is going to make it through. So Luke's whole thing is to try and impregnate the Death Star, again, trying to elevate Saturn lead into something higher, trying to transmute it. He's trying to penetrate it. All those stormtroopers are literally cloned, identical sperm, little white fucking things around this egg. Luke's the one to penetrate it. Now, this makes sense if you consider it with 2001 A Space Odyssey, which essentially ends with a giant fucking floating space baby.
Oh, I got it. I think I got it. Okay. Saudi is not the star, right? Saudi is seven. Saudi is the sword, is the lover's card, right? There's a whole thing in Kabbalah with the sword basically pierces the crown. You'll see it in the Ace of Swords, where you have this sword with the crown. The place 777 comes from, Kabbalistically, is actually the crown, because three tzadis on top of the letters in the Torah. So, like, you basically have this symbol where you have a yud and you have a vav. And the yud and the vav come together to form the tzadi. And that is actually taken to be the Keter being united with the Tiferet and the Malkut being united with the Tiferet at the same time. It's this whole, and it's actually taken as a sexual act. The fact that you say then Saudi is not the star, you have the fucking Death Star, like, is a false star, right? And then you have the fact that it's the Emperor is taken then as Saudi, and then you have Hay, which is the Shakina itself, is equated with Hay, like, as in, like, the Adonai, you know, there's two Hays in Yud-Hay, Vav-Hay, right? And the last one is the Malkut and is the Shakina. You take that as the star then, and then you make it the Emperor, and Emperor is Empire. You're making the Empire, which is the Malkut, into a masculine symbol. You're giving over to that. And so that's what the fucking Death Star is. And that's why it's like, that's no moon, you know, but it's not a star either.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So if you have an alchemical marriage, is the sun and the moon. So if it's actually not a star or a sun, and they say that's no moon, what is it? It's the child.
Right. Wow. Totally. Well, it's the child in potential that something's going to be born out of the destruction.
Yes.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah, that was recent. I came across that studying with my rabbi, and I had to, like, stop everything and be like, wait, because the crown, there's this crown on top of the letters of three tzadis, and it's this huge, like, esoteric thing in Kabbalah, but it's a significant thing. It's the crown itself is three tzadis, and that's 777. And then I'm like, I never get a real explanation from reading the European occultists, because they never fucking drop that, even though they're supposed to know that. I mean, I'm sure they do. So that's weird.
Violet, yes. Have you seen this more recently? I don't know if it's just implied or if this is in my imagination or not, but it seems as though in the episode 6, when again they're trying to penetrate the egg, and at the same time, Luke is fighting the Emperor, and then Darth Vader throws him through the window. Again, I don't know if this is just implied or if this is just my imagination, but it seems as though the dead Emperor is essentially getting thrown into that same middle chamber that the pilots are flying into.
Does it gets thrown into the reactor.
Yeah, so it's like sort of like here we have the King Kill and his rebirth at the same time, because he's falling down into that center point only to have the Death Star explode and essentially our space baby be born at the same moment. So the death of the king is the birth.
Right, and then you burn the mask of Anakin, right?
Yeah, you're burning away the impurity of Saturn. He's going from Negredo to Albedo. You're essentially taking that the blackness off him. Not, I mean, you know, I guess there's a. I don't mean that racially. fucking James Earl Jones. James Earl Jones gets a short end of the stick on that one. So.
Yeah.
Oh, now that's interesting. In Conan the Barbarian, James Earl Jones also turns into a giant snake.
Oh, shit.
Right, which is...
the base of Kundalini, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, at the Malkuth.
Yeah.
Totally. Wow. That's nuts.
And isn't he also in Lion King? He's again the dead king lion who dies, and they whole sing Circle of Life.
Right, and then he's in the stars, right? He sees him in the constellation, is that correct? I forget how, or he's in the cloud or something? What's the fucking deal? I haven't seen The Lion King since I was a kid. I should probably watch that again for synchronistic purposes. But
it's basically like the end of episode 6 where you see the glowing blue... Like, my whole thing is, in 2001, you see this glowing blue space baby in the sky. In Lion King, you see the glowing blue dead king. And in episode 6 of Star Wars, you see the glowing blue Obi-Wan and Anakin and all of them glowing blue as the, you know, ethereal versions of themselves.
Right.
They've become indigo children.
Oh, wow.
When I get big, I'm going to get an electric guitar. When I get real big. To rust. The king is
not forgotten.